Thank you very much, Dave, and thank you for the invitation. So I'm Marceline Oosterdorp from Stellenbosch University in South Africa. You will see on my first slide a picture of my university, and not to make anybody jealous, but this is more or less what it looks like today. The sun is out, blue skies, few clouds, but nothing to write home about. Right from the outset, I want to say that the presentation I'm going to be giving today is based on collaborative work. So I am working together with Lulu Duke and Simangela Mashazi from Stellenbosch University, and also Shone Pretorius from the University of the Western Cape. So if you look at the title of my talk and the abstract, you would see that Audre Lorde has been an inspiration for this project and for this presentation in particular, and particularly her essay called Poetry is Not a Luxury. And this essay is in her famous essay collection called Sister Outsider. And in this essay, she argues that the value of poetry does not necessarily lie within the linguistic manipulation or the manipulation of form, like us linguists are so often interested in. Instead, the value of poetry is that it provides a form for ideas which are not yet formed but felt. And it's specifically this not yetness that I want to focus on today. Forms of knowing, doing that are possible but not fully realized yet in the teaching and in the research of sociolinguistics or applied linguistics. So, in today's presentation, I will present poetry that was created by students in a postgraduate course designed by Stellenbosch University and the University of the Western Cape. And I will give you some background on these two institutions and on the course itself. And I'm presenting this poetry to discuss the potential of poetic forms of engagement as a form of linguistic citizenship. And this idea of linguistic citizenship will also be further unpacked in the presentation. Another aim is to challenge pedagogy and research in applied linguistics and social linguistics, and present glimpses of thinking language otherwise. Okay, so to give you some background about the two institutions, as I said on the first slide, there was a picture of Stellenbosch University. This is also where I am employed. Stellenbosch University was started in 1918, specifically to serve the or to serve students who were white Afrikaans-speaking students. And as all educational institutions in South Africa, it was segregated. Black students could not enter the univer get entry into the university until the 1970s, and then only under very strict circumstances and with a special permit. This university is often associated with Afrikaner nationalism, and that is because the first prime ministers of the apartheid regime were all educated at Stellenbosch University. In fact, the building that I'm talking from today used to be called the BJ Foster Building, which is an apartheid prime minister of note. So post-apartheid, the university has really struggled to redefine itself as all universities in South Africa, and to transform, but still the majority of students at this university are white, the majority of staff are white, although the numbers and the demographics have been changing slowly. The University of the Western Cape has a very different history. So this university was started in the 1960s to serve as a tertiary institution for so-called coloured students. Now, this racial categorization, coloured, is going to play an important part in the presentation, and I will give you a little bit more background on it. But in brief, it's those who during apartheid were classified as not native or white. So there was those were really difficult to put into these two racial categories, and this makes for heterogeneous group. And both my parents, for example, were classified during apartheid as coloured. But I'll talk a little bit more about the specific racial classification. So the University of the Western Cape was specifically designed for colored students. It started out as an Afrikaans institution, but in the 1970s and 80s, this university declared itself the intellectual home of the left in opposition to the apartheid government, and also declared that the doors of learning shall be open. So any student who wanted to study at UWC could study at UWC. And this was, of course, in direct opposition to the segregationist laws that was in operation at the time. So post-apartheid, this university struggle is to be recognized as a fully fledged research-intensive university. It was never the aim of the apartheid government to create a university that serves the colored population to be a research-intensive university. So the course that from which this poetry emanated came out of a joint project between these two institutions. And we think a lot of the value that we got from this course was particularly because this university has, the two universities has such different backgrounds and histories. And we are still entrapped by apartheid architecture in South Africa. So the segregation is continuing. And by bringing students from these two campuses together, we could move towards a different kind of space. So to tell you a little bit about the course and the research project, as I said, from which the poetry emanated, the course was called Reimagining Multilingualism, or is called, it's still ongoing. So we started running it from 2018, right after the fallist movements in South Africa really gained ground. So the Roads Must Fall, Fees Must Fall student movement. Quite rightly so, students during this movement started calling for a decolonized curriculum. There were also many other issues, but this was a main issue on the list of these student activists. And our course benefited from funding that we got from the Andrew Mellon Foundation in a project called Unsettling Paradigms, which was specifically about decolonizing university curricula. So I think the idea around the course is quite transparent from the name. The idea was to sort of rethink multilingualism in ways outside of coloniality. The course was offered at honors level. So in South Africa, your honors year is your fourth year in a bachelor's program, but it is a year that you only gain entry to if you applied for it and you got accepted into it. So it's regarded as our first postgraduate year. And this module focused on reimagining the ways in which we teach about multilingualism, but also what we teach about multilingualism. So we had, originally it was conceptualized as 5-day-long seminars that alternated between the two campuses. So students were bused in. Luckily, the two universities are not too far from each other. And 1 week, the seminars would be at UWC, and another week, it would be at Stellenbosch University. Some of the topics that we covered were focused on linguistic ethnography. We used visual arts methods for creating concepts around multilingualism. We had a dedicated seminar on multilingual creative writing, semiotic landscapes, reimagining formal linguistics, and then linguistic citizenship formed a big part of the conceptualization of the module and the theoretical orientation of it as well. And I'll get to linguistic citizenship a little bit later on in the talk. So the content of this module has changed slightly over the years. One year we had a dedicated seminar on multilingualism and disability, one year on multilingual music, and so forth. But of course, the biggest change came in 2020. So 2018, 2019, these modules were offered face-to-face. And we even managed to have student exhibitions of the work that they produced as part of the course. So I talked about how we wanted to challenge pedagogy and research, but an important part of the module was also challenging standard assessment practices. So instead of requiring students to complete the standard academic essay after the seminars, each seminar required students to create a multimodal piece, which we tried to make as open as possible, and to have a creative means of rethinking theoretical concepts in social linguistics and applied linguistics. So, as I said, the biggest change to the module came in 2020, of course, with the lockdowns in South Africa, and we were probably one of the first courses in our department to be affected by it. It was scheduled to be run from March 2020. So in 2020 and 2021, it was offered almost exclusively online, with really minimal participation from the UWC students because of the different platforms that we used for online teaching, and we didn't want to add on to the pressure of these students by asking them to get familiar with yet another a platform as well. I already talked about what the assessment entailed. And since 2022, the course is back to being face-to-face. But by now, the funding has run out, so we are only offering it now at Stellenbosch University, but with guest lectures from lecturers at the University of the Western Cape. So something that really struck us was the large number of poems that were submitted as assessment. And in 2018 and 2019, we actually had poetry writing workshops. So we kind of expected poetry to be a form that a lot of students would engage with, but that was not the case in 2020, 2021, and up to today. But still, poetry seemed to be a very popular means of engaging with the course material. And it's the poetry specifically that I want to talk about today. And a lot of these poems or these poetic pieces could be seen as what Cummins called identity texts. However, we found in our course that it went beyond the affirmative dimension. It was not only about students getting a chance to showcase their linguistic repertoires, their cultural knowledge, but we actually found that our students in a way became co-theorizers with us, using the affordances of poetry to provide imaginative possibilities for themselves and for language. And we have also engaged these students in various ways, in publishing with us, leading edited collections and so forth. So in this presentation, I'm going to argue that this poetic engagement actually provides a form of decolonial theory and praxis. So from the beginning or early on, I said that linguistic citizenship played quite a big role in the conceptualization of the research project and the module, the teaching component as well. And what is linguistic citizenship? It's a theoretical approach that emerged from Africa. So Christopher Stroud coined the term, who's worked for many years in Mozambique and in South Africa, became sort of disenchanted with the linguistic human rights approach, which was the dominant approach to language policy and planning. And in his experience, very often language policy interventions worked much better if it was a grassroots movement, if it was bottom-up movement by the communities himself. So with this knowledge, he started theorizing around linguistic citizenship. And linguistic citizenship is how people leverage their semiotic resources to create voice and agency and new participatory spaces for themselves. This can be in formal spheres, but very often it's outside of formal institutional formats. More and more, the focus of linguistic citizenship is not only about carving out new spaces, but also carving out new relations between people who were traditionally othered, seen as separate. And it's also about understanding how to engage affect and vulnerability as a political project, as claiming citizenship for yourself. Linguistic citizenship encompasses practices such as translanguaging, which I think probably quite a few people who have joined today might be working with. So practices such as translanguaging can be forms of linguistic citizenship, can also be forms such as resemiotization and regenering, and semiotic acts, which entails the reshaping of meaning across context, modes, and materiality to make oneself visible and audible. But these acts of linguistic citizenship can also include the use of standard linguistic varieties. So it's not only what we recognize as hybrid or mixed or translanguaged varieties, but also what people would normally classify as standard language varieties can also be used in processes of or in acts of linguistic citizenship. And I have an example of what I think such an example of this. And you have to bear with me for a little bit because this is a rugby example and South Africa has just won the Rugby World Cup. So please bear with me. But those of you who might be following rugby know that the current South African rugby captain is the first Black South African captain. So Siya Kolisi is also a speaker of isiXhosa. And during the first game that he led South Africa as captain, Black isiXhosa commentator commentated in Xhosa, and he used these very standard Xhosa practices, oral practices of praise poetry, of knowing your lineage, of acknowledging where you come from within this rugby commentary. And although these are standard linguistic varieties, he inserted Xhosa in a space where it was not usually seen as being the norm, as fitting in. And it was to claim a new subjectivity of a Xhosa speaker, a rugby player. So I'm going to quickly play that clip for you, which is just 1 minute, and then I'll move on from the rugby. So the central quality of a linguistic citizenship approach is that an abyssal line is crossed. Either the linguistic variety is inserted into a space where it's seen as the other or not usually used. Other modalities can be engaged. The line between embodied and disembodied are perhaps blurred and so forth. So all of these different ways of crossing an abyssal line are qualities of linguistic citizenship. I think a nice summary of what it entails is from Stroud and Bock 2021, where they say that a linguistic citizenship approach means understanding how new subjectivities and agencies are co-developed in synchrony with new registers and styles of speech, including multilingual and multimodal repertoires. Okay. So who are the poets that I am going to be talking about today? So I'm going to show you two poems, both produced by to colored women who have CARPS in their linguistic repertoires. As I said, the colored is a apartheid racial classification which was used with people who could not be easily categorized as white or native. It is of, it's a contested identity category, but people are also reclaiming it, reaffirming what it means to be colored. And it is still quite widely used in as a self-assigned identity marker and also by the government for redress purposes. CARPS is a marginalized variety of Afrikaans that are associated with colored speakers. It's a variety that emerged out of language contact with slaves at the Cape, indigenous population, the Dutch settlers, and so forth. Okay, so the first poem that I'm going to present emerged out of a task that was given in the first year that we ran the course in 2018. The task was to think about syntax differently. So we discussed verb second constraints in Germanic languages, but then also talked about recent research which seemed to see that there's also the seem to indicate that there's also the possibility for V3 in certain urban vernaculars, and that this use of V3 might be a deliberate identity marker. So the task that was given to the students were seed a discussion on ungrammaticality in Foster, drawing on principles from linguistic citizenship, provide an alternative definition of ungrammaticality, and provide a short discussion of how you arrived at this definition. And most students followed the brief. They gave us almost like a dictionary definition of ungrammaticality, and they brought in aspects of power and identity into this definition. One student, however, did not follow the specific brief and instead wrote a poem. And it's this poem that I'm going to present to you. And we also asked her to record the poem, and we used it in the exhibition as well. I also have the poem sort of written out, and I'll take you through it as well. So, my words paint a picture, mix of colors, just like me, my grammar, my pronunciation, where I place my verb, three-dimensional in shape, every side saying something new. They tell you where I'm from, who I am, and who I want to be. So when I say, Ekblaeni Athlonen, you immediately know the fabric of me. The words I use paint your picture of me and what I want you to see. So you will see that the poem is entirely in English, but there is one insertion, one quote in CARPS, Ekblaeni Athlonen. She uses a so-called ungrammatical form of Afrikaans with the doubling of the preposition. So the standard Afrikaans would be Ekblaen Athlone. But this doubling of the N is a standard feature of, or is often used in CARPS. Athlone is a neighborhood that was previous or during apartheid was classified as colored. And she basically says, I live in Athlone. Okay, so what is so interesting about this poem? Firstly, the fact that Abigail here performed an act of epistemic disobedience. She did not follow the brief. She did not write a definition. Instead, she wrote this poem. And what we found very interesting was that she did not just write new content for the term ungrammaticality, like the brief asked her to do and like most of the students did. She, in fact, changed the very terms of the conversation. She broke the stranglehold of formal standard academic English. She infuses this poem with her locus of enunciation, the place from which she speaks quite literally by saying, Eglay and the Athlone. It's clear that the student engaged with the task given, because she talks about where I place my verb. She uses an explicit marker of ungrammaticality, but she's changed the terms of the conversation by not giving an all-encompassing, masterful definition of ungrammaticality, but instead says what it means to her. So she brings her own body into this poem, and she engages in the politics of relationality. She enfleshes this term of ungrammaticality and tries to wrestle control from those who define what a language is by saying, what I want you to see. So, like Stroud et al. Argues in 2021, through using linguistic resources and refiguring the genre that was expected of her, she shows how bodies are implicated in important sociopolitical processes as sites of resistance, comprising points around which new alternative subjectivities and socialities can congeal or be contested. I'm going to move on now to the second poem. And I think I am going to maybe skip a few bits, but we'll see how it goes, just to give enough time for discussion. So the second task emerged out of two seminars, one on multilingualism and disability, and one on linguistic repertoires. And students were tasked to think about their linguistic repertoires in relation to their bodies, but also thinking through this idea of an accessory. So this might sound like quite a strange way of getting them to think about their linguistic repertoires, but we were using some visual arts practices of forcing connections, of serious play. So we used this idea of accessory. We gave them different definitions of the term accessory, and then gave them the following tasks. So we wanted them to, by using any of the definitions of an accessory, think of at least one linguistic variety in your linguistic repertoire that you would see as an accessory, then go and find an object or take a photo, make a sketch that can symbolize the semiotic variety, and then explain your choices. And we were giving them quite free rein about the form that it should take. It could be a written narrative, essay, poem, voice recording, whatever. Okay, and then we have one student, Jill, who wrote a poem and then also had a kind of a companion piece going with a poem. The first part of the poem, the class wrote together about their bodies. And the second part, Jill wrote on by herself. And this part is very interesting because it switches between, standard English and then CARBS, with the CARBS ones in quotes. It basically is almost like a call and response format. There is sort of a diss and a countering to it. Just because of time, I'm not going to go into this part all that much. I will read it for you so you have an idea what it sounds like. So, my hair is untamed, but you think that's lame. Komi somiyo leka bosikop. The marks on my skin tells the story I'm in. Chayun skulle la dikyo leka kate tu. With my nose, I can smell your envy. Se dungse skwai lang mar and blerion dankbar. My voice might be different, but it still has strength. Chelek Indian, matujay is the yomot upmak nai, colored for bay. So she talks about all of the ways in which she has been identified by others through her hair, through the way that she speaks, through her posture, the and so forth. And she sort of counters it at the end by saying, I do not need eyes to see your judgment. I do not need ears to hear what you say, but we are not going to talk about this. Together with this piece, she also produced this drawing, and she gave an explanation for this drawing. So she said that, so the one on the right is her curly hair, her natural hair, and that's her most versatile accessory that she wears every day, and that is a representation of carbs. Just like my hair, carbs is like a loyal best friend. It has stayed with me through all of life's adventures, and likewise, it transitions with me through all of life's changes. As with my natural hair, my use of carbs is spontaneous. I get to be myself, unfiltered. It's part of my heritage and always perceived as different. And while it is not as essential in my day-to-day life, it adds to the beauty of that which makes me who I am. And then the other picture is the straight hair, and that represents more standard English. Okay. So what is very interesting out of her poem, unfortunately, I couldn't really unpack that bit for you, but out of a poem and a drawing is that, well, she presents her hair in combination with her linguistic repertoire as a tactical weapon that she can employ, where she presents different parts of herself. She is very aware of the fact that there is a continual racial monitoring of her body and of her linguistic practices. But instead of, say, of sort of choosing between them, I would say she's trying to inhabit a kind of a mestizia consciousness, as Gloria Anzaldúa calls it, by developing a tolerance for contradictions, a tolerance for ambiguity. A drawing with the two heads, one on the same body, visually depicts that she conforms and resists within the same body, with you know, that she can do it at the same time. So to move on to what this means for the teaching, the researching of social linguistics, of applied linguistics, I think that these two, that the vulnerability of these two colored speakers of Afrikaans is actually used here productively in their assessment to discursively work out a different positionality for themselves, a positionality where they can define whether what they speak is ungrammatical or not, a position where they are not constrained by choosing, but could be either or, could decide when to resist, when to comply. And they do this by re-engaging their linguistic practices with their bodies, by making their local enunciation very, very obvious, by talking about language in connection to where they come from, the bodies that they are emplaced in, to talk about the histories connected to being colored, the histories of mixing, of hybridity, of being told that you don't fit in anywhere. And I think that the poetic engagement with language that we see emerging out of this module, out of these two poems, allows the ability to go beyond linguistic and modal constraints. And these participants can actually imagine new possibilities for themselves. So in terms of a more decolonial social linguistics, I'm going to propose that a more poetic social linguistics could be one pathway into a more decolonial social linguistics. And with this, I mean a social linguistics that is engaged in open-endedness, in embodiment, in locality, grounded in these things. And this can provide, as Audre Lorde says, a foundation for a future of change, a bridge across our fears of what has never been. But as Audre Lorde also cautions, possibilities are neither forever nor instant. So a decolonial social linguistics also entails sort of always reaching for a utopia, even when we know we will not be able to catch it, for the not yet that are there, where there are glimpses, cracks, and fizzes, but is not fully realized and might never be fully realized. So I want to end off with this quote from Catherine McKittrick, Black Studies scholar, from her book, Dear Science and Other Stories. And she says these kinds of strategies, reimagining the Black aesthetic, creative knowledge, disobeying the disciplines, viewing Black texts as verbs rather than nouns, engendering interhuman relationalities, asking the groove and the poem for theoretical insight, provide intellectual spaces that define Black humanity outside colonial scripts. And this is what I want us to think through, how we can find those intellectual spaces in social linguistics that are not defined by colonial scripts. So in closing, I can just say that Abigail's poem is part of an article that was just published, I think yesterday, so just published in Applied Linguistics called Failing Fortunes of Applied Linguistics Towards Surviving Mastery. So if you want to read a bit more around the analysis about the course that this emerged out of, please go and read it. It's open access as well. Yes, and this is where I'm going to end. Thank you very much for listening to me and with bearing with me with a few little glitches. Thank you so much.